All right. So good morning. Welcome. I'm Timothy Scott Johnson, currently at Texas A&M Corpus Christi in the Humanities Department. So the panel today is slightly different, but it was based on, initially when I started reading, Steph's new book, Transparency in Postwar France, just out with Stanford, that I thought it'd be really interesting to get other people's takes on it because it's such a an interesting book with a lot of diverse elements going on. It covers a large amount of terrain. And so I thought, what better way to help me make sense of it than to have a bunch of people coming from different angles to talk about it as well. So it's completely selfish on my part. And then both Todd and Michael were game, so this is great. So before we get going, especially if people haven't had the chance to read the book yet, I wanted to just briefly talk about some of the main themes before introducing both Michael and Todd for their individual interventions. So the book provides an interesting way of thinking through many of the central preoccupations of post-war France, mainly through the lens of culture, society, and ideas, by focusing on the concept of transparency, which at once is highly general, but when you get into the specific context, it has really, really specific connotations. And so by looking through this broad frame, it's able to provide really interesting inflection point or guiding reference to make sense of a pretty broad constellation of themes. So ranging from, and I'll just list a couple, the legacy of Vichy and the state police procedures. And here I recommend Steph's journal, essay in the Journal of Modern History, which covers, I think, pretty much material in two of the chapters of the book, to existential phenomenology and then existentialist political commitments, reframing of society's symbolic nature and structuralist anthropology and Lacanian psychoanalysis, the critique of scientific claims to total objective knowledge, the advent of cybernetic thinking in the humanities and social sciences, to the emancipatory aspirations of May 68, and then the anti-totalitarian moment of the 70s and 80s. So I think whatever angle you might come to the book with, there's something of interest for just about everybody. Methodologically, it builds off the insights of conceptual history and the study of metaphor, charting the changing valences, the concept of transparency, and then particularly against its counter concepts. So transparency versus obstacles, opacity, masks, particularly in the sort of really Rousseauan sense of masks. And then the various horizons of meaning and expectation they invoke. So transparency here casts a really wide net across much of the French intellectual life. And then with each successive chapter, we're presented with a new set of problems regarding transparency. So the book unfolds almost in a sort of negative dialectic of different ways people are invoking transparency as a problem, and then the other problems that generates throughout. And so in this way, Steph gives us what he calls a history of the present. So a way of looking beyond our own current discussions of transparency, and then here, problems with the hyper-information age, email spying, government, reach into our private lives, all of those things that are all too familiar, by giving us ways that the French from the 40s to the 80s thought about pretty much those same sorts of preoccupations. So while much of Western history from the Renaissance to the present, or even going back to Aristotle with the ancient Greeks, has tended to valorize transparency as an ideal for science, self, and society. So you can think here of like Bacon, Descartes, Rousseau. Steph shows the various ways transparency was raised as a problem from the 40s onward. So it's a problematic in one sense, since the goal of an all-seeing state manifested in pretty unsavory ways under the Vichy regime in post-war bureaucratization and increased police powers during decolonization. But then transparency was also an epistemological problem for the practice and theorization of medical science, anthropology, political theory. So the goal of having absolutely clear knowledge of a subject in the Enlightenment sense becomes an issue that people start to refuse pretty pretty roundly. And so, in brief, rather than total transparency being something French society and French intellectuals simply objected to as an aim, it was also an unachievable goal. As a result, many different theoretical positions needed to be fundamentally reevaluated. And so if you're familiar with Steph's other work, then you'll recognize the ways this book draws on themes he's already explored, French anti-humanist thought in Western, in the 20th century, the history of science and medicine, particularly pertaining to the writings of Georges Canguilhem and his disciples, film criticism, and then theories of political sovereignty. So at this point, rather than interrupt the flow of the papers, I just want to briefly introduce all three of the people here. So Michael Berendt is Associate Professor of History at Appalachian State University. He frequently comments in English on French politics and on American politics in French, appearing both in print and radio. So while his work deals broadly with French intellectual history, the 19th and 20th centuries, he's been working on Michel Foucault's intellectual development, as well as the careers of his disciples, particularly François Ewald. So most recently, he edited a fantastic forum on the career of Gerald Siegel in modern intellectual history that I recommend. And his article, The Origins of Anti-Liberal Left, the 1979 Vincennes Conference on Neoliberalism, just appeared in French Politics, Culture, and Society. So Michael's paper is titled Patterns, Webs, and Warps, and he'll address the methodological issues in Steph's book. Todd Shepard is the Arthur Lovejoy Professor of History at Johns Hopkins and the co-director of the program in the study of women, gender, and sexuality. He also has published widely on the role of Algerian decolonization, especially the role that decolonization plays in modern hexagonal French history. And most recently, he published Sex, France, and the Arab Men, 1962 to 1979, along with a French version that also came out last year, I think. And his paper is going to look at the ways that Algeria, UNESCO, and post-45 France interact. So thinking about Steph's story in terms of questions of national, colonial, transnational, and other analytic frameworks. And then last but not least, Steph will have the chance to respond before we open up for the audience. So Steph is Associate Professor of History and Director of History Graduate Studies at New York University. Aside from the book under discussion this morning, he's also an editor at the Journal of History of Ideas, co-editor of the edited volume Scaffolding of Sovereignty, a translator of two collections of Georges Canguilhem's writings, and then has co-authored a number of books with Todd Myers, Experimenta im Individuum, Kurt Goldstein, Und die Frage des Organismus, and then The Human Body in the Age of Catastrophe, which I think is forthcoming. Yeah. And his first book was An Atheism That Is Not Humanism Emerges in French Thought. So thank you. And I think Michael. Yep.
So it's my pleasure to be here, and indeed I was very pleased to be invited to participate in this panel and to have an opportunity to really do a kind of sort of oral book review of Stephanos's new book. It's a book that I admire greatly. It covers, as Scott was saying, a really wide swath of French intellectual history. It really sort of testifies to great erudition, and I think it's an important book on the history of 20th century French intellectual life. It does, however, adopt a different methodological perspective than the one that I am used to thinking about and using in my own work in intellectual history. So my paper is really going to explore the methodology used in this book, and perhaps to explore some of my reservations about the approach that it takes. But I'd like to begin, even though Scott has already done this to some extent, to, since I'm not sure that everybody in the room has necessarily read the book, to kind of give you a sort of a fairly kind of detailed overview of the book before I specifically take on some of the methodological issues. So to consider the book, or to give you an overview of the book, let me say something about what's dealt with in each of its sections. Part one seeks to establish the significance of transparency for intellectual history in general and for 20th century French France in particular. The result of Gerulanus' brief survey of references to transparency in Western philosophy is his conclusion that, as he puts it, the transparent is a figure of epistemological as much as visual import. Specifically, he says, the transparent was a concept and a metaphor for the presence and materiality of the world to the perceiver. In different ways, this idea, he argues, was the premise of such landmark thinkers as Descartes, D'Alembert, and Auguste Comte. It is precisely this nexus between perception and epistemology, between vision and knowledge, that is, in Gerulanus's account, challenged in 20th century French thought. Transparency, if I understand him correctly, became a way of talking about the real, if not always evident, frames that separate the world from the perceiver. And I'm in thinking about the appropriate metaphor here to use. I thought of frames, but possibly films, lenses, something along those lines. Gerulanus writes that transparency as a concept, quote, denotes at times by way of optical metaphors a concurrent presence and absence, or presence alternating with absence, which allows something to appear across. Something that generally does not interfere unless itself foregrounded, something that is there but absence itself in a way that it makes itself aware of its presence, something that is not present in the same way as that which it lets appear, end quote. I would propose summarizing this passage, which is admittedly difficult, yet crucial to the book's argument, as follows. Transparency as a concept implies two actions or movements. First, the act of passing through, and second, the obstacles that delay or refract this passing through, though these obstacles might be what makes that which passes through them appear as they are. Once upon a time, transparency meant the former. In the 30s and 40s, it increasingly implied the latter. In other words, the obstacles rather than the passing through. The moral murkiness of the Second World War injected into French culture a new fixation on metaphors of night and darkness that rendered earlier ideas of transparency problematic. But the driving force behind this new way of understanding transparency, i.e. the obstacle rather than the passing through, was the intellectual movement that coalesced around existentialism and phenomenology. Whereas neo-Kantianism had been concerned with demonstrating the harmonious fit between the material world and consciousness, Sartre and Merleau-Ponty in the 30s and 40s became concerned with the opaque resistance of things to the human subject. From this standpoint, there were fewer greater threats to consciousness than its equation with one of the opaque entities in the world, a situation Sartre famously defined as bad faith. His example being, you know, when I think that my essence is being, you know, a college professor or a waiter in a cafe, whichever it may be, the equation of a subjectivity with an entity in the world. The only authentic attitude available to the subject in the face of the onslaught of opaque objects for Sartre was sheer negation. Sartre, in this way, is emblematic of the central role that opacity came to play in conceptualizing the relationship between perception and knowledge, nowhere in the world in French thought of the 30s and 40s. In part two, Gerulanus turns from the kinds of philosophical and specifically epistemological questions raised by Sartre and his contemporaries to the problem of what he calls social transparency. The epistemological problem of transparency concerned the relationship between perception and knowledge. Similarly, or by analogy, social transparency is concerned with the relationship between state and society. He writes that transparency should not be seen simply as a demand for transparent government or justice, but as, quote, a conflictual negotiation of the accessibility of resistance of social formations to the state and vice versa, end quote. To be analogous to his claims regarding epistemological transparency, social transparency cannot just mean for Gerulanus a social space sort of bereft of obstacles, a space that one passes through. It also means highlighting the film or layer that must be passed through. In his account, this film or boundary is that between society and the state. Social transparency means, therefore, the degree to which society is rendered visible and knowable to the state by virtue of that which parses it off from the state. Gerulanus explores this theme historically in two ways. First, through an examination of specific ways in which, in the immediate post-war years, he thinks the state tried to make society accessible, often only to encounter society's resistance. In the relationship between police forces and distinctive forms of criminality, notably the black market, as well as in the broader concern with dealing with social misfits or inadapté through a range of institutions, such as psychiatric hospitals. Secondly, he examines the political thought of post-war Marxists, Merleau-Ponty, Lefebvre, showing how, even as they believed a transparent society was the only alternative to capitalist obfuscation, they nonetheless abandoned a range of concepts premised on the idea of transparency, notably that of history and social space as transparent. So that the Marxist critique became about challenging a threatening form of obscurity in the name of one that was more in keeping with the ideas of human emancipation. In part three, Gerulanus examines a range of issues that in France sprang from the problem of transparency, even if the specific term was not always used explicitly. The idea of the face, the idea of norms, and the idea of the symbolic. But I'm going to return to these issues a little bit in more detail later in the paper. The final part of the book explains the historical course of thinking about transparency in French intellectual life in the 1960s. The ultimate result of this disparate yet consistent preoccupation with transparency was the formulation by French intellectuals of a new conception of modernity. With all the major thinkers of the so-called structuralist movement, Lévi-Strauss, Lacan, Foucault, Derrida, as well as fellow travelers such as Canguilhem or Starobinsky, what they all shared in common was a view that modernity began with and was dominated by the idea of a self-sufficient and self-transparent cogito, a move associated with Descartes. Their goal was to show that, quote, the world was not as the moderns had promised, that man did not come to see his own face in the mirror, that communication could not be trusted to carry one meaning, that curing patients was no given, and that the skepticism that emerged in the early post-war period was morphing into a huge effort to rethink the modern tradition and perhaps heal it without repairing its violence, end quote. In addition to diagnosing transparency, they sought to reveal opaque, even obscure spaces through which alternatives to the exclusionary machine of normalization and technological domination could emerge. The new philosophical outlook found a challenge, however, when confronted with the events of May 68. Not only did their ideas about structures and deceptification come face-to-face, this is again a quote, with a concrete revolutionary agent that pursued real social transformation, but it shifted the register of the conversation about transparency from the epistemological ontological to the political. This critique of transparency in this context became primarily associated with political concerns, especially anti-statism. At the same time, a different alternative to transparency emerged. Ending transparency in the wake of 68 finally acquired a positive meaning. It meant endorsing complexity and irreducibility, taking up a chance at the liberation of difference and self-division, meant engagement with the multiplication of this difference. Althusser, De Boer, Clastres, and Foucault all sought ways to liberate individuals and society from subjection to the state. Meanwhile, according to Gerulanus, Claude Lefort and his circle came to criticize the idea of a self-transparent society, which they saw as an implicit assumption of Marxist socialism as leading inevitably to totalitarianism. Yet this highly politicized critique of transparency ended, Gerulana suggests, not with the bang of emancipated difference, but with the whimper of liberalism, which he sees as coming to have dominated French society in the 1980s, not least by championing a new idea of social transparency, symbolized notably by legislation such as Freedom of Information Acts. Only a few figures from this earlier generation, such as Jean-François Lyotard, clung to the earlier idea of calling attention to all that was dangerous and violent in the idea of transparency. So once again, I think this is a really sort of compelling, well-researched, well-argued narrative about 20th century French intellectual thought, French intellectual life, but I would like to sort of now offer a few thoughts on methodology. The existential dilemma that most intellectual historians grapple with is the question of their relationship to history. That doesn't sound like history is the kind of comment they fear and loathe, but to which they are commonly confronted. I would like to address in particular the question of the historical character of Gerulanus' book. Specifically, I would like to raise a number of issues relating to the problem of context. What role does context play as an explanatory framework in the book, and what are some implications of the methodological choices relating to the context that he makes, relating to the context that he emphasizes in the book? In the section of his introduction that addresses methodology, Gerulanus describes his approach as that of semiotic history. The goal of such history, he says, is to pull historically relevant meaning out of the uses of an idea that seem to mirror, that seem minor on its terms, which are meticulously woven into the fabric of post-war life and thought. In this spirit, he embraces the idea, which he attributes to Wittgenstein, that we should focus on the uses rather than the meaning of words. He proceeds to expand these intuitions into a more comprehensive conception of intellectual history, which he claims it is one of the goals of his book to test drive. He defends what he calls the web as a model of for conceptual history, which is grounded in Clifford Geertz's oft-quoted remark that man is an animal suspended in webs of significance he himself has spun. Gerulanus turns this into a model for intellectual history with the following thought experiment. Quote, imagine a web made of strings. At each point where two or more strings intersect, they are tied together into a knot. Sometimes only a couple of strings cross at an intersection point. At other times, there are many, a thicker knot. Some strings begin at one knot and end at the next. Others begin at one knot and go through several others before being tied at the last. As they extend between different knots, strings sometimes get tangled. Many strings allow some leeway. You could pull a string or a threading and watch other strings tighten or move. You could affect a different threading or even break a part of the web, end quote. Concepts are the knots on the web, and to write their history is to address the way they are strung together, pulled, yanked, sometimes in one direction, sometimes in another. Intellectuals are those who engage, create, and give new shape to the web. This intriguing methodological discussion illustrates very lucidly the approach Gerulanus, in fact, takes in the book. The strings are something like the persistent units of meaning that persist over time. Individual ideas, words, figures of speech. And when I describe them as units, I do so deliberately. There is a bit more similarity between this conception of intellectual history and Arthur Lovejoy's undeservedly forgotten notion of unit ideas than I feel Gerulanus is prepared to admit. And I think we'll see what happens, but we have the editor of Arthur Lovejoy's journal. We have the Arthur Lovejoy professor. I bet I'm the only person who has Arthur Lovejoy in his remarks, but we'll see. Epistemological notions, but I think there is something. Basic point is, I'm not trying to say it's exactly the same thing, but this notion of strings, I think, is actually quite similar to Lovejoy's notion of unit ideas and how they develop and operate over time. We can talk more about that if necessary. Epistemological notions of knowledge as a kind of light, cultural discourses about criminality as a form of darkness, the state as an institution that oversees society, each of these, I think, are what Gerulanus calls strings. He traces their contours, particularly interested in moments when they come together to form conceptual knots, such as Merleau-Ponty's idea of ambiguity, Foucault's idea of surveillance as a form of power, Lafort's idea of totalitarianism as a self-transparent society. Tracing the history of these concepts allows him to develop a narrative that is the core of the book's argument. The way a debate about transparency in the realm of epistemology develops into a broader philosophical position that then becomes a part of and shapes the political idioms of the late 60s. So far, so good. Yet this methodology is also founded, and this is, I guess, the point where I'm going to sort of lay out the way how I see intellectual history differs from that defended in this book. This methodology is also founded on a rejection, or at least a marginalization, of a concept that many intellectual historians regard as central, the idea of context. At one point, Girolana says that he has opted not to pursue what he calls, quote, a contextualist reduction. At another, he says, quote, concepts do not rest among the clouds to be stared at, contextualized, or historicized from the real vantage point of society, end quote. This opposition to context rests, I believe, in several arguments. First, as Girolano says, concepts strung together in a given space have a temporality and a life of their own. Not quite attached to specific intellectuals or social political circumstances. This, I would add, is another kind of unacknowledged filiation with Lovejoy. Second, Girolana seems to suggest that concepts, or perhaps cultural strings, often already structure the contexts that are invoked to explain them. He writes that more often than not, these concepts structure, clothe, and stage the circumstances and events in manners that historians are often eager to ignore. I think Girolana's means something like this. It's confusing to invoke May 68 as a context, say, for understanding Foucault's or Clastres or Lafort's critique of social transparency, because May 68 was an event that was already steeped and shaped by the problem of transparency. This idea seems to hark back to efforts to formulate a deconstructive approach to intellectual history, which was commonplace, or at least happened, in the 1980s. In this vein, for instance, Dominic LaCapra criticized what he called a documentary approaches to intellectual history, precisely because they see texts as needing to be explained by real history. Intellectual history, LaCapra argued, needs to remember the relationship can work the other way, that it's not just contexts that shape texts, but that texts themselves can shape contexts. It seems to me that Girolana's suspicion of context is in this vein. His final assumption is that the appeals to context are reductive because they posit a causal relationship between context and concept rather than seeing them as consisting of different stretches of cultural strings that can intersect and become knotted together in different configurations. So while I admire the book's erudition and the fascinating story it tells about post-war thought, most of the aspects I find in it that I'm less persuaded by, I think, have to do with its suspicion of the explanatory value of context. I think the problem is that Girolana is too inclined to associate context solely with attempts to reduce concepts and ideas to non or not exclusively ideational or cultural factors, such as social structures or political movements. Yet the kind of contextualism favored by scholars such as those belonging to the Cambridge School, Quentin Skinner, John Donne, John Pocock, emphasize precisely that the best way to understand context is not as something exterior to text, but precisely as discourse, a set of discursive arguments or rhetorics or patterns of speech that constitutes something like the common assumptions of a particular community existing at a particular period in time. Understood in this way, context does not have, or at least have to have, a reductive or passive function, as I believe Girolana implies. Understood as discourse in the Cambridge School sense, context is precisely a set of linguistic and conceptual tools that allow those who adopt them to use them. Discursive contexts in the Cambridge School sense are determinative in some ways, the kind of tool at your disposal, after all, places some restrictions on the kind of things you can do with it. But it is also performative. It implies agency, hence the importance of Austin's linguistics to the Cambridge School. You can do things with linguistic tools in ways that may in fact alter the tools with which one is operating. This is precisely what people like Skinner want to understand when they try to relate a thinker like Machiavelli to the context of classical republicanism, to arrive at a better understanding of what Machiavelli intended by grasping the constraints weighing down in his thought, but also to understand precisely and to locate precisely the exact sort of point of originality in his thinking. So I think one of Gerolanus' strings could in fact rightly be called the original context for this whole conversation about transparency. I say this without certainty, but it seems to me that the story works like this. The discussion of transparency in the 20th century begins, as I think he very clearly shows, with the epistemological discussions that occurred among French existentialists and phenomenologists in the 30s and 40s. This, it strikes me, really is the triggering context, the one that provides the kind of template for the subsequent moments addressed in the book. What makes this discussion distinctive, and here I'm both drawing on Gerolanus but also bringing in some of my own thoughts in this, what makes this discussion among the existentialists and phenomenologists in the 30s and 40s distinctive is the way that opacity ceases to be not simply the opposite of vision and knowledge, but constitutive of them. For Sartre and Merleau-Ponty, and I know I'm shamelessly conflating them and simplifying here, but roughly speaking, for them, the fact that my mind is part of a body, the fact that I can only ever see from a particular perspective, or the fact that I can never see all the sides of a three-dimensional object at once, are not limitations on knowledge. They are precisely what makes knowledge possible. So things that had seemed as obscure to sort of previous generations of philosophers become constitutive of a notion of the visible and perhaps the transparent as well in this particular context. This insight, I think, is tied to an epistemology that is rooted in radical finitude. The idealisms that Gerolanus is critical of cling to an idea of a transcendental subject or some equivalent, that is, to a kind of ideal but continuous viewer of the world, to whom the world presents itself as permanently transparent, as permanently available and therefore transparent. French existentialism and phenomenology are premised on the insight that there is no transcendental subject. I think that's generally true in any case, that our consciousness reveals the world to us, but in a way that can never overcome or cancel out human finitude. And by the way, I'll just say in passing that even though Foucault is kind of one of the subjects, or the objects in a sense, one of the topics addressed in this book, Foucault's reflection on the central place of finitude to modern thought in the order of things is something that I'm drawing on in sort of making this analysis of phenomenology. And I think Gerolanus does as well. This is, I think, what makes transparency a problem, a pressing problem at this particular juncture. Transparency comes to mean that which is both threatening and authentic and inauthentic, while opacity becomes a mark of authenticity and closely wedded to the two ideas of truth. The existentialist and phenomenological movement strikes me as not just one string that can be teased out of a wider and more complex web, but rather as the primary context for the discussion, the context that largely forged the language and ideas in which subsequent iterations of this conversation occurred. Very roughly, I would say that a model for this approach to transparency, this might seem like a strange kind of stretch, but can be found in Pocock's approach to classical republicanism in the Machiavellian moment. That is, examining the approach one might take is to examine the successive forms a discourse takes in different contexts. The Italian Renaissance, the Civil War in England, and the early American Republic for Pocock. For transparency, existentialist and phenomenological epistemology in the 30s, the critiques of this epistemology in the 60s, and then the reconfigurations of these ideas after 68. The reason I would advocate this approach is because I think it allows one to delimit the topic of transparency and the context that trigger a discussion of it much more carefully than the alternatives. One puzzling feature of Gerald Onnes' book is that despite expressing a kind of skepticism towards contextual approaches in its methodological discussion, it proceeds to resort to a kind of contextual explanation in the book's early chapters when it addresses the issue of why the discussion of transparency is particular to post-war France. The problem, I found these arguments to be among the most strained in an otherwise persuasive and admirable book. The problem has precisely to do with the way Gerald Onnes understands post-war France as a context. Without being a Marxist, his understanding of context recalls the way some Marxists understand ideology as a simple reflection of prevailing social structures at a given time. To admittedly simplify the argument, Gerald Onnes thinks that there is something dark and shadowy about post-war France that kind of seeps into contemporary French thought. Thus, he writes, the cycle of war, occupation, resistance, and collaboration, and liberation disrupted standard philosophical categories. They no longer appeared efficient. I'm just not convinced that this is the case for the material that Gerald Onnes is addressing. He implicitly acknowledges this on the next page after the quote that I just gave you, when he acknowledges that phenomenology's effort to abandon idealism and reach the concrete had begun in the 1930s. Hence the point I made earlier. Doesn't this suggest that the triggering context is a very specific conversation about transparency and opacity that emerges in French thought in the 1930s, which develops a set of terms and concepts that can then subsequently serve as a framework for discussing particular events such as the French experience of the Second World War? Understanding the existentialist moment as a context in this kind of Cambridge school sense, i.e. as a set of discursive conventions, would, I think, not only clarify the way these ideas unfolded over time, but would nip in the bud the temptation to characterize the French experience in World War II as sort of dark and shadowy, which may be true up to a point, but which seems a little over essentialized. And to allow him to cling to this earlier moment, to the existentialist and phenomenological moment, it would prevent him from sort of clinging to an argument about post-war France as the most readily available form of contextual explanation. So I think that in a way what I'm sort of in a sense kind of arguing for is the narrowing virtues of a certain kind of idea of context understood in this way rather than the sort of more kind of expansive approach that Gerald Onnes' methods lead him to. Last night my colleague and I went to the Andy Warhol Museum, and there's in Pittsburgh, I suggest it, and there's a great quote there where Warhol says, I don't think less is more. I think more is more. I think more is better, you know, and maybe that's kind of the difference between us, you know, in this. I'm sort of making an argument in a certain sense for less is more, whereas I think that for you know, many interesting reasons, Gerald Onnes is more skeptical of that or reticent to go that way. I also think a more robust understanding of context would address another problem I see in the book, which is that what I would call its tendency, I dub this the tendency to metonymic inflation. And I feel entitled to sort of, you know, use that language since he asked for it in a sense in calling his book one of semiotic history. So I'll bring a little semiotics into it. What I mean by that is the way the association, the tendency of the book to associate transparency with a whole series of related but different concepts, which allows him to shift the discussion away from transparency and to focus on other issues where the connection between them is in my mind a little more tenuous than he suggests. These concepts include, among others, the concept of face, normalization, and the symbolic. So In chapter 12, for example, which is on the norm and the same, Gerulonis connects transparency and the idea of norms by saying that transparency is the presupposition that makes norms and their imposition on others possible. Maybe. But I just don't think that the subsequent discussion of normality and normativity, which focuses on sociological discussions of normality from the 30s on, and then on Conkey-Lem's thought, bears out in any kind of rigorous way that this conversation is fundamentally one about transparency, even in the sense of being one of the strings bound up with others in a conceptual knot. The historian here is positing an assumption, i.e. that normativity assumes transparency, that is plausible and that he builds his argument on without necessarily sort of carefully identifying this connection in contemporary discourse, at least as I read it. Once again, a clearer sense of what the triggering context of this discussion is might have reined in some of these explanatory sort of elaborations of the book's key term, or at least made the relationship to one another clearer. Finally, this is my final point, one feature of this book that is both intriguing and problematic is the way in which transparency is presented not simply as one interesting theme among others in French intellectual history, but in a sense as the, or at least a crucial concept to understanding French contemporary thought as such. This is a fair enough argument to make, and in this sense it does recall, as Gerulonis acknowledges, Martin Jay's similar study from several decades ago, Downcast Eyes. But the problem is that by building a historical narrative around the critique of around the critique of transparency, the book becomes, not always unwittingly, a triumphalist account of the rise of the generation of French thought associated with Foucault, Derrida, Lacan, and Althusser, among others. It requires him to characterize earlier periods as benighted, although given the way the book's metaphorical system works, I should perhaps say illuminated, as they have not yet incorporated the critique of transparency. Gerulonis refers in the context of a discussion of Merleau-Ponty, quote, to the pre-war premise of natural attitude, transparency, self-evidence, and confidence about a better future. But as a characterization of European culture in the 1920s and 1930s, this claim seems stretched, somewhat stretched. The French thinkers that are treated in this book are described as having founded, he uses this term on several occasions, a new enlightenment, showing Cartesian modernity as obsolete, hopeless, and destructive, as they reveal the violence of transparency and the opaque, even obscure speeches through which alternatives to the exclusionary machine of normativization and technological domination could emerge. The story does present itself to a significant degree as one of how a group of French thinkers overcame the simplistic and oppressive ideas of an earlier generation and at long last got transparency right. Paradoxically, I think, Gerulonis has written what you might call a Whiggish history of postmodernism. Those are attempts then to sort of lay out some of the ways in which my own sort of tastes, I suppose you could say, in intellectual history differ from this book. And I look forward to the discussion. But, you know, once again, I think that this really is a powerful and compelling account of a French intellectual life in the post-war period, one from which we can all learn a great deal. I think it'll become a work of reference. So if you haven't read it, I encourage you to do so. And I look forward to our discussion. Thank you.